This is Martin Luther King III, and you're listening to Make It Plain with Mark Thompson.
All right, all right, all right, all right. It's time for BC Check-In, blackcommentator.com. That is, we feature one of the contributors to blackcommentator.com every Thursday. Very esteemed guest today, who's an editorial board member, a religion columnist, theologian, and public speaker, a native of Brooklyn. She's a graduate from Wellesley and Union Theological Seminary at Columbia University, served as a pastor at an African-American church before going on to Harvard Divinity School for her doctorate as a Ford Fellow. Her book, Let Your Light Shine Like a Rainbow, 365 Days a Year, Meditations on Bible Prayers, will be out in June of this year, next month. I'm going to get that. As an African-American feminist theologian, she speaks for a sector of society that is frequently invisible. Shares on website, IreneMonroe.com, traditional spelling, IreneMonroe.com. We're happy now to welcome the Reverend Irene Monroe. Reverend Monroe, God bless you.
Why, thank you. Thank you for having me back again, Mark.
It is good to talk to you. I'm reading your piece today, the cover story, Nobody's Daughter. This is your story.
This is my story. That's right.
I had no idea. Mother's Day is upon us, as we all know. But you don't know where your mother is.
That's correct.
Did you ever meet her?
No, that just wasn't possible. Part of that has to do with the way in which I was abandoned.
You were left, dumped as an infant in a trash can in Fort Greene Park in Brooklyn.
That's correct.
At birth?
No, actually, 6 months. At 6 months. Let's say this. They estimated that when they found me on that particular day, which was July 11th, that I might have been 6 months. So they gave me a birth date of January 11th.
But we don't have any way of knowing whether that's your actual birthday.
That's right. That's right. And and what happens when a child is abandoned, and usually a child is abandoned, you know, right at birth, but at 6 months, sometimes a name is left, or even just one name is left, but the first name at least. But I had no name. There was just no data on me. So I was taken to the New York Foundling Hospital. And I get the name Irene Monroe because back in the day, the Catholic Church ran most of the public orphanages in New York City. And Sister Irene, who was the head nun of the New York Foundling Hospital, was a Marilyn Monroe fan. And so she gave me the name Irene Monroe.
Your mother attempted to abort you.
Well, that you know, those are the stories that they tell you that, you know, sort of this was sort of a botch abortion here. I was quite a sickly child. I came in the world pretty sick and consequently struggled with, you know, health issues all my life. All my life.
Because you talk about the scars, and maybe I'm misreading it. You are scarred.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a metaphor.
No, that's not a metaphor.
And those scars came from that attempted abortion or some other or some kind of abuse?
We assume it's some sort of abuse.
At the hands of your mother?
Well, that's what they say. We assume that it could have been her boyfriend. Maybe I should read that part to the audience so they know what we're talking about.
Well, you know, I think I'd like you to, because this, You know, some things you can talk about, other things people really need to read. And I want people, folks, if you never listened to me before and you are disobedient every Thursday, because I ask people to go to Black Commentator every Thursday. If you've been disobedient in the past, you ought not be disobedient today. This is a compelling story. Irene Monroe's nobody's daughter. Do that for us, Reverend Monroe. Let's look at the whole thing. The entry in your diary of July 10th, 1969, you were 14 years old.
That's correct.
Read that entry, please.
Okay. It says here, Mama's gone. Mama's been gone all my life. Kids rudely ask me how I feel having no mother, especially around Mother's Day. I tell them I really am okay about it because they don't know I feel Mama with me all the time. They don't know she really never left me, and we always have our special day each year together. Tomorrow will be our anniversary again. I will go over to the spot in the park where we were last, but this year, due to an all-paid free trip to Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, because of good grades all year, I'll be out of town on July 11th. I'm leaving early tomorrow morning on a Greyhound bus. I hope Mama won't mind my skipping out on her like that, but there is no way that I can tell her I won't be there at our usual spot. I hope this won't be the time she actually shows up. I get a tinge of anxiety and expectation every July 11th. Tomorrow, I'll actually miss Mama and my anniversary. The family report said Mama left me wearing a pink dress. So every July 11th, I show up at our spot wearing something pink and new. I bought a pink halter top the other day from King's Plaza Shopping Mall. Although I won't see Mama, I'm going to wear my top tomorrow anyway under my white blouse. I am still Mama's baby girl, and she knows it. I think she would be real proud of me because I'm thinking about college now. I just really, really hope she doesn't show up looking for me tomorrow. I'll go to our spot when I get back and tell her all about Cornell.
The Reverend Irene Monroe, folks, nobody's daughter. Do you still do that? Do you go every year to that place where your mother left you?
Well, I must tell you, when I left for college, I stopped going to that spot in Fort Greene Park, thinking that she might show up. There's no other way that, you know, there's no marker here. There isn't a way that. If you're looking for your mom or you're looking for someone that you've lost, it's like so you go back to that spot. So, you know, it's like what animals do. You go back, you know, if your your animal gets lost, and I've lost my animal a number of times in the park, my dog, you know, he or she would go back to that spot where we last were together. And so it seemed sensible to me, you know, as a 14-year-old, well, all my life, to just go to that spot because only she and I would know of that spot. Nobody else would.
Who raised you?
I was raised through the New York City foster care system. I was one of many hundreds, I think, of hundreds of thousands of kids on the Bureau of Child Welfare.
And so you grew up in the foster system?
In the foster system.
And you are at Harvard Divinity School.
That's correct.
You came from the trash in Fort Greene Park in Brooklyn to Harvard Divinity School. Correct?
That's correct, yes.
Glory be to God.
Well, yeah, I tell you, and I always tell folks, you know, in our country, we have this notion of rugged individualism. And I have to say that, well, my story isn't about that. My story really is about the help of people seen and unseen to get me where I am. And when I say unseen, I'm talking about someone who sends in a donation to the Fresh Air Camp and said, well, let me give to this organization because I think, you know, urban kids should get out to the countryside. And behold, I was one of those kids that benefited from that experience.
Forgive me, I'm typing something. I'm sending an email. I'm emailing your story to every woman I know. blackcommentator.com. You all need to read this, Nobody's Daughter. Now, I want you to read the other letter. This is July 11, 1999, 30 years after the first diary entry we just read. The Reverend Irene Monroe, ladies and gentlemen, July 11, 1999. Would you read that one for us, please?
Oh, sure, sure. My inner orphan lives with the pain of being nobody's child. This child cannot help but feel at times like she's a piece of trash, a piece of shit, garbage, a nobody. This child has to lean on the adult woman in me to calm her down. She rationalized nothing, and she feels everything. As a matter of fact, when it comes to truth-telling, my inner orphan is a lot more honest than the adult woman inside of me. My inner orphan is the spirit of me. She embraces her sensory knowledge and remembrance of my mother and their last hours together. The adult woman in me, on the other hand, questions the same knowledge that also lives inside of her about those final moments together and their first 6 months of life. For example, my inner orphan knows that it's obvious that my mother did not really expect me to live with her not being in my life. This child knows I am my mother's botched abortion that she concluded 6 months after my arrival. While it is hard for the adult in me to accept this fact, my inner orphan runs my hands along the keloid knife zigzag scars that snake up and down my body and ask, what is this? The scars on my body read as an abuse narrative somebody authored with my flesh and was never held accountable for. The way my mother scripted our last minutes together in the park was a perfect goodbye scene where neither of us would be able to step back into each other's lives again. Although the adult woman in me can intellectually derive a myriad of reasons for my mother's actions, particularly understanding black women's choices in 1955 and the struggles intrinsic to their lives, my inner orphan doesn't give a damn about the reasons and is mad. She is enraged by the permanency of my mother's act and wants to snatch Mama and shake her into consciousness, yelling, don't do this, Mama. You can't do this. Mama, please don't do this. But Mother, our mother, Mama, did it nonetheless. In Mama's final step out of my life, she left me without telling me my birth name. Mama left me without telling me where I was born. She left me without telling me my date of birth. Mama dumped me in a trash can in Fort Greene Park in Brooklyn, leaving me with no identity. So in the face of our final scene together in the closing act between a mother and a child, my struggle has been, how does one start with nothing and make something of a life?
The Reverend Irene Monroe. Have you your own family now?
Oh, I sure do. I mean, you make family with friends and people that, you know, you journey through life with.
But you don't have children of your own?
No, I don't.
Okay. Does sharing this, well, let me ask you this. Is this the first time, Reverend Irene Monroe, that you have, forgive me for not knowing, but that you have written about this publicly?
Well, this is the first time I've shared it. You know, I wrote this memoir some years ago. This was part of what I call dissertation avoidance behavior. Sentence a day on the dissertation. I said, shucks, let me write my memoir.
Yeah.
But what happened is that, you know, I realized that people like happy endings, which in some way it is a happy ending. And I just felt like, oh, well, this is so raw of a piece. I don't think anybody would want to read this because, you know, it's hard reading. And I mean, in terms of the emotionality that it can bring up. And I was asked, Peter Gamble, who's the publisher of Black Commentator, said, well, I'm doing a piece on Mother's Day. Why don't you write something? And of course I went, and I always hate to say no to Peter. And I said, well, I have something. And so I figured, well, instead of sending him the chapter or excerpt of the chapter, I would just send him the prologue because I felt if the prologue was too much, surely the chapter would be just overwhelming.
Nobody's Daughter, blackcommentator.com. What does this do? Well, let me ask it this way. I'm going to ask another question. Are you still healing, or are you healed?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. Well, I think that you're always, I think you always are healing from a tragedy. I mean, I'm certainly not where I was, you know, 30 years ago, and certainly as a kid who was a ward of New York State. I'm certainly not that young woman who, you know, when I was a undergraduate at Wellesley, and you have all these women who say, well, I'm the daughter of this, who's the daughter of that, and who's the daughter of this, and when my turn comes along, I can't, I don't have that. I don't have that lineage to say, well, I'm the daughter of, and actually it really was being at Wellesley that I remember I got up and said to folks, because they were going around the table and says, well, I'm the daughter of this and the granddaughter of this, and I just said, well, I'm nobody's daughter. And, of course, they thought I was joking, and I was very serious. And so when they pushed me on the issue and I told them, you could hear a pin drop in the room. There was this sort of uncomfortable, pregnant pause. Nobody knew what to do. I felt like, uh-oh, well, maybe I said too much.
How old were you when you were told, when you found out that you were left in a trash can?
I had an abusive foster mother, and her mantra to me was that I come from nothing, I am nothing, I'll be nothing. And, of course, at some point, you know, you think, well, that's just hyperbole. This is, you know, this is a woman who's angry, you know, blah, blah, blah. But when they showed me the Foundling report, when she showed me the Foundling report, because one day she was just like, you know, you're just a piece of shit. Excuse my language, but that's what she said. I was just dumbfounded. Like, oh, my God. You know, it was just a blow.
Wow.
So, you know, and so, of course, you know, this is sort of trying to enroll me into school, and, you know, here's a kid who just doesn't have a birth certificate.
As appropriate, you're a minister. I mean, you have a testimony. If anybody has a testimony, you have one. And forgive my tone and reaction, because I didn't know your story. And it's really something how, you know, humankind may not plan on us being here, but there's a divine order that ordains us to be here.
That's right. That's exactly right.
I mean, if humankind had its way, of course, if your mother had her way, you would not be here. And yet you somehow, a way was made. You're supposed to be here. This is Mother's Day. How do you feel about that? What do you deal with? Because a lot of people have issues, some identical to yours, some not so identical, and yet we still suffer. A lot of people probably listening tonight are saying to themselves, wow, I thought I was suffering. I thought I had it bad. And then they hear your story, and it really humbles you to really wonder whether or not you have the right to complain about anything. seriously, I mean, you know, we all think about that. You know, a lot of stuff we talk about, we're not talking about 100,000 people being, you know, dead over in Burma. I mean, that's real. We're talking about Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. That's what everybody's talking about every day, as if that's life and death. We're not talking about 100,000 people dead. We're not talking about your story, because there are other Irene Monroes out here in some context.
That's right. That's correct.
So what happens to you on Mother's Day?
Well, okay, there are a couple of things here. One is certainly, you know, there was a moment when I was a kid, and this will certainly date me, but when you would go to church on Mother's Day, if your mother was dead, I think you wore a white carnation, and I think if she was alive, you wore any other color. And so I wore nothing. I didn't even put anything on because it's like, I don't know if she's dead or alive. And then I figured, well, instead of people asking me, oh, you know, why don't you have a carnation? And I would sort of flub and say, oh, I forgot my carnation. Or, or some would say, well, let me put one on. And it's like, oh, no, that's all right. Then I decided I'd wear white because then it would connote that I had a mother, but she's not there. And then I stopped that because they would, you know, they say, oh, you poor child, you're without a mother. What happened? And I had no narrative. So I went back to just wearing no carnation. And so clearly going through life with this story, this sort of huge chunk of information missing from my narrative, I had an enormous amount of angst. It was exacerbated a lot of times with kids jeering, but it didn't help having a foster mother. That her job is to mother, and she was being paid for it to do that. She wasn't very good because I think that if she was a much more nurturing type of mother, the struggle wouldn't be as difficult. I think that. When I got older, one of the things I began to realize is that my story, as you had said earlier, isn't probably that different than a lot of other, you know, kids who are abandoned for whatever reasons. But one of the things I began to think about very seriously was that, who is this woman? What must have been going on in her life? And so I'm thinking, okay, this is 1955. Clearly, Roe versus Wade was not available. And I'm also making, we can make this assumption, well, if she had the money, or, you know, maybe she would have had an abortion. Or who knows, her religious belief might have prohibited her to do so. Who knows? But clearly this much, I think, is a good assessment. It is all, you know, it's all conjecture here. This was a woman who clearly had some sort of isolation, serious isolation from community. Because I felt like, well, if she was a middle-class woman, clearly they would have been, and, you know, she had a family network. Clearly it's an embarrassment in 1950s and even 60s to, you know, to be an unwed mother. But how likely would she have been thrown out of the house? The kid would have probably gone south somewhere and gave birth to the kid and left it with an aunt or whatever. And if I said, and if this was a kid who grew up in the projects like I did, clearly it's an embarrassment, but, you know, the kid still would have been, had some sort of community. And I was assuming that here's this young woman or kid who brought this kid in the world. The child is at least 6 months from what, you know, they estimated. She either had to be in serious isolation for someone not to know that this kid or woman had a child, because black folks call you out. Black folks will say, well, where's that baby? You know, people will say, well, didn't you, where's that baby? What,
yeah,
did you
yeah.
do with the, you know, people
yeah,
call
yeah.
you out.
That's true. That's true. Especially, okay. especially back then.
But they do. They just really just.
We were more in one another's business back then.
Absolutely.
Than we are today. We need to go back to that, frankly.
Right. So my thing is that, right, there was nobody in her business.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It could have been, well, maybe she was from out of state. Maybe she was a runaway. Mm. Maybe she, too, comes out of an abuse situation. Who knows? You know, we just read, I don't know if you heard this, about this man, and I forgot, in Austria or maybe Australia, who for 24 years kept his daughter in a cellar, and impregnated her, and they had like 7 kids.
That
was in the news just recently.
Just last week.
Right. So her narrative, you know, is missing too. We don't know exactly what happened to her to put her in that sort of situation. And in some way, it might have been for her the most liberating thing to do is to just dump the baby. One way to say, I can start anew. I clearly was a sick child. And if she's this teenager or young mother, certainly no means to take care of her, who knows? And certainly no support system, and I mean like immediate family.
You don't know your name, your mother's name.
That's right. Don't know my name.
What would you say to others, especially on this weekend, who find themselves also as nobody's child?
Well, there are a couple of things. And I'll have to tell you this story. There was one time, you know, so I was in therapy about this. I need to confess. I mean, you know, you get thrown in a garbage can, you're going to have some issues, you know. And if you don't address...
Although I doubt that there is any clinical training that one has for that. But I'm sure you were in therapy, but go ahead. I just can't imagine, you know.
But Mark, I agree with you because the therapists were in as much shock as I was.
Yeah, I don't even know, you know, I just can't even... Yeah. But anyway, so you were in therapy.
But there's this particular day in therapy, and I'm just bawling. Mother's Day is coming, and I'm just saying, and I'm saying I'm nobody's daughter. I have no, you know, just mm-hmm. bawling. Just the feelings that would come over me in this particular session, and you know, here I was just crying. And she said to me, I know you feel this way, and I can't erase those pains. But you can't ignore a couple of things. You can't ignore the life that you've lived and you've created, the family and friends that you've made, and the grace that God has bestowed on you. And I really had to think about that. It's like, you know, you're absolutely right, because when I think about, you know, particularly going to a place like Wellesley and